You're listening to one in a series of podcasts from the 2009 High Ed Web Conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
All right, well, my name is Paul Gelzon. I'm with the University of Missouri at the Department of Web Communications. If you'd like to get a hold of me afterwards, it's pretty easy. Actually, if you do a Google search for Gilzo, I'm pretty much the first four or five links. But you can hit me at either Gilzo on Twitter or gilzo@missouri.edu. Before I get too far into it, I would like to say thanks to Michael for telling me about Prezi, and then also my graphic designer, Josh Nichols, back at work for helping me with the presentation design. He's the one who decided we should go with the 80s retro video game theme and do some Space Invaders. So real quick, how many of you in here have heard about cross-site scripting? Good, pretty much everybody. How many of you have a pretty good idea of how it works? A couple of you in here, all right. How many of you have used it to actively exploit a website? All right, the FBI would like to meet you after the presentation. All right, how many of you have done a JavaScript development? Good, a good chunk of you. How about HTML development, at least? Okay. All right, so we've got a fairly diverse population here of experience. So what I thought I'd do is I'd kind of start at the base and kind of just build up from there to make sure everybody's kind of on the same level playing field. So all of our browsers, just talk about browsers real quick, all of our browsers adhere to what's called the same origin policy when it comes to JavaScript. What that means is JavaScript is only allowed to interact with other JavaScript and other pages that all come from the same origin. That means the same domain, the same protocol, and the same port. And this should make sense. Obviously, if you've got Facebook or Twitter up in one browser window or tab, do you want it to interact with, say, your bank that you've got up in another browser or tab or another window? Do you want those two to be able to interact with each other? No, you don't want those to interact with each other. So that's what that same origin policy does. It says, all right, you cannot jump over out of that same origin into somewhere else and interact. You have to stay within the same origin. Cross-site scripting, though, attempts to bypass that same origin policy through injections. Now, what I mean by injection is anywhere in your site that accepts user input, the attacker tries to slip in commands that hopefully the server will send back out to the browser. Because if the server sends it, well, then it's from the same origin, right? The server sends that information back to the browser, it is from the same origin. So it's attempting to bypass that same origin policy through injection. It usually happens in the form of one of two ways. Either HTML code, we've got something like an image tag, and they set the source to JavaScript, or through an actual script element, where they've actually said, okay, go out to a whole other site and grab this JavaScript file. Now, cross-site scripting is not an attack against your web server. It's not even an attack against your website. It's an attack against your web users. What it does is it attempts to exploit the trust that your users have for your site. It's also usually an indication of a much larger problem. If you've got cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, there's a good chance you've got other vulnerabilities, cross-site request forgery, SQL injection, etc. All right, so we need to talk about how big of an issue this is. I had hoped after last year's presentation, because I gave this last year, I had hoped that cross-site scripting this year would be a thing of the past and I would have nothing to talk about. Instead, that's not the case. It's actually even worse. So some quick stats real quick. In 2006, WebAppSec scanned 12,000 sites. Of those 12,000 sites, almost 70% had cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. On to 2007. In 2007, they scanned almost 33,000 sites, found almost 70,000 vulnerabilities. And out of those 70,000 vulnerabilities, almost 60% were cross-site scripting. Now, unfortunately, I can't find any statistics for 2008 or 2009 specific to cross-site scripting, but you can see in 2009, the state of affairs as far as security on the web has gotten worse. In the last year, there has been a 671% increase in the number of sites that are currently sending out malicious content. Huge increase. In addition, this one down here, 61% of the top 100 sites are either hosting malicious content or contain a mass redirect. One of the things that you can do with cross-site scripting. All right, so it's not gotten any better, unfortunately. So what are some of the dangers of cross-site scripting? What exactly can an attacker do? All right, again, it's usually just the first step in a larger attack. I can take a cross-site scripting vulnerability, combine it with another site that has a cross-site request forgery vulnerability, which we'll talk about in a minute, and combine those two to be able to replay attacks. That can lead to defacement, but that can lead to identity theft, or spam, or phishing. We can deface sites. We can totally change the way they look. If I can load my JavaScript into a page, and several of you have said that you've done some JavaScript development, if I can put JavaScript on a page, what can I do to the page? Anything, right? How many of you were in the jQuery session earlier? Okay, so you saw some of the things that you can do with jQuery, right? Well, if I can get an injection, a cross-site scripting injection in there, I could load the jQuery library in addition to loading all my scripts. And now not only can I just use my own script, I can use jQuery to even make my scripting even easier. So all kinds of things that you can do. Yeah. Use a framework to help me out. One of the big problems is it's platform independent. It doesn't matter what OS it's on. It doesn't matter where it's at. Anything that runs a browser, that can run a browser, that can run JavaScript, is vulnerable to these attacks. All right. So because of that, it can spread much faster than traditional viruses. How many of you remember the Sammy worm that hit MySpace a couple years ago? 3 or 4 years ago? It was a cross-site scripting worm that spread throughout MySpace and infected over 1 million users in less than an hour. No other virus, no other piece of malware has spread that fast. And think about how dangerous it's getting. How many of you have a cell phone that has a web browser? Yeah, almost everybody anymore. Everybody's got one. I was at Best Buy. There's a refrigerator that has a browser in it that runs JavaScript. Yeah. So there's a coffee maker that hooks up and has a browser in it. I don't know why, but it has one in it, and it's vulnerable to cross-site scripting. So anything that runs a browser. And I don't know if you've heard, there's been a lot of talk in the last 6 months or so about the browser becoming the next OS, because we're running so many applications inside the browser. That's good in one aspect, because that means your applications are available anywhere in the world. All you have to do is get to the browser, and you've got access to your applications. The problem, though, is because of these vulnerabilities, that means it can spread that much faster and jump over between platforms. The last one, my favorite, though, he kind of made it a little smaller than I want him to, but whatever your devious little mind can think of. So whatever you can think to do, once you own that page, once you control the DOM, as you saw earlier in the day, if you were in the jQuery session, you can do anything to the page. You can make it look different, you can send it somewhere else, you can collect cookie information, anything you want. All right, so what about education? How prevalent is it in education? Now, this is actually from 2008. It's a security consulting company. They scanned 900 sites. Out of those 900 sites, 88% of the educational sites they scanned had high vulnerabilities. High vulnerabilities include SQL injection, cross-site request forgery, or cross-site scripting. So it's a huge problem. Every year before I come here, I kind of go through the list of people who are coming. I go to your school site, and I start tinkering a little bit. And at least 6 out of 10 of the sites I scan always have at least one problem. All right, so now let's talk about why, as an institute, why is the higher education specifically, why are we such a target? How come we're so attractive to attackers? Anybody have a guess? Yes. Decentralized is a big one. There's usually, especially in larger schools, there's no centralized service. It's all decentralized across the whole place. You never have consistency. It's very hard to get a .edu. You can't just be anybody and sign up a .edu. Well, technically, you're not supposed to be able to sign up a .edu. There have been some instances. But you should be a higher ed institute. Student information. There are all kinds of student information. What was that? Trust it. Yeah, exactly. Because people trust us. People trust our sites. As an example, my wife is a high school science teacher. Every year this comes up. She'll be grading papers, and a student will try to use Wikipedia as the source in their paper. And she gets all upset. And I said, okay, well, you've got 5 or 6 different sessions, 30 kids in a class, you got like 180, 200 students, and you're grading all these papers. How in the world do you flesh out all these sites that they've sourced to be able to know which ones are legit and which ones are not? She said, well, we do one of two things. Either we give them a pre-approved list of sites that they can use, or if it's a higher ed site and the information looks correct, I'll let it pass. So again, people trust our sites. All right, now the guys from UNL are here, so I'm going to pick on for just a second. One of the things that has made this even worse in the last year is URL shorteners. Because what does a URL shortener do? Shortens a link, right? So do you know, when you click on a link, do you know where you're going? No, all right? And one of the things that has been happening a lot recently are higher ed institutes instituting their own URL shorteners like UNL did with go.unl. All right, so let's say that you meet some people here at the conference in the next couple of days, like myself and maybe one of you guys, send you a link. Now, you're probably not going to trust any link I send to you after this conference, but pretend that you do. If you got these two, which one would you trust? UNL. Why? Because you think it's UNL, right? They're another higher ed learning institute. They're good. They got their stuff together. They know what they're doing. Well, at the time when these two were generated, they both went to the same compromised site. Now, I will give them credit. After I went back to them and I said, I don't know if this is such a good idea, they fixed it. They took care of it. You cannot, as an anonymous person, set up links to malicious sites. And I'm not sure exactly what they've done to fix it, but I've tried a couple more times. It blocked it. So they've done a good job. But if your school is thinking about doing this, make sure you don't just let anybody create a link to any site, because attackers are going to jump on this. All right. But you could say, okay, but wait. We've told our users, we've trained our users not to trust links from everybody, to be suspicious. They're good about this. They know. They're not just supposed to click on any link that comes in an email or Twitter or wherever I am. Back last year, September 2008, North Carolina State University did a little study. They set a group of people in a room, and what they did is they had them working on a workstation, and occasionally a little pop-up message would show up, and they'd have to click on OK or cancel. And what they did, some were legit, and some were supposed to be malicious. They weren't really malicious, but the intention was that they were malicious. And the first time through the study, it was like 98% of the people hit OK. They said, OK, well, something must be wrong. So they went back, and they actually told them. They said, OK, look, while you're working, you're going to get these pop-ups, and sometimes they're going to be legit, and sometimes they're going to be not legit, and you need to pay attention. And despite that fact, 63% of them still click the OK button. Just click OK. Yeah. So again, it's a big problem, because if they're going to just click on any old, you know, any old OK that pops up on them, how easy is it going to be for me to trick them into clicking on a link, especially if your institution has set up a URL shortener and it's a .edu? Pretty easy. All right, so let's get specific. Let's talk about what the three types of cross-site scripting are. Three main types. First is called non-persistent or reflective. A reflective cross-site scripting is the most common, but it relies heavily on social engineering because it's only alive, it's only viable as long as the victim is on the page. So all of you are familiar with a URL. You know you got a question mark at the end of the page, and you got a bunch of parameters after that. In this case, in reflective cross-site scripting, the payload, the actual attack, lives in the URL. It lives in one of those parameters. And that's why it relies on that social engineering. I've got to trick you somehow into going to that page. All right? The next type is called persistent or stored. Very common in web forums, social media sites, etc. Any place where you've got users generating content or contributing back into some type of storage system. You're taking information, you're storing it. It's a little bit more difficult because they're little, usually those types of things are locked down a little bit more, but you don't have to rely on social engineering because now all I have to do is get a user to go to the site, and because it's stored, the server or that website replays that attack back out to everybody who comes there. In fact, let me back up. Twitter had some problems with this recently. I don't know if you paid attention in the security world at all, but Twitter had a lot of problems with some cross-site scripting worms because they weren't filtering out some of this stuff and was being able to spread from account to account. Those were persistent types. The last type is called local. It's much less likely, but it's still highly dangerous. How many of you have noticed that, especially in the recent past, a lot of your help files for your desktop apps are web-based or HTML-based? I should say not necessarily web-based, but HTML-based. Some of those HTML files are vulnerable to cross-site scripting attacks. Now, it's difficult as an attacker to get these to run because now I've got to know what OS you're on. I've got to know what programs you're running. I've got to see if you've got those programs installed in their default locations. In other words, I've got to target down to those vulnerable files. But if I can find one and I get it to run, that attack now runs with the same privileges as the logged-in user. And how many of you run Windows in here? Nobody wants to raise their hand. How many of you that run Windows run as an admin? Nobody's, okay. All right, so that means if I get that attack to run, what does my attack run as? As an admin. There's been some really interesting proof of concept exploits out right now. where just going to a website will launch the calculator. Depends on the browser. To a degree. But remember, as far as the browser's concerned, the instructions are okay coming from that site. I haven't jumped in from somewhere else. Yeah, so in a calculator, you might say, okay, big deal, a calculator launch. But I've launched that attack has launched a program on your computer and ran it as the admin. But it's much harder, like I said, because you got to know all that background information. All right, so I'm going to do what we'll do now is we'll kind of walk through some verbal examples of the three types, and then we'll do some live demos. And I know that's what most people are here for, the live demos. So I'll go through these pretty quick. Real quick, OPA, some little acronyms in here. OPA is the Online Job Application System at the University of Missouri. So if I refer to OPA, that's what I'm talking about. If I say PawPrint, that's our single sign-on ID. That's what we call it, our single sign-on ID. All right, so applicants have to register at this online job application system, and they save sensitive data with their account. Names, addresses, possible social security number, work history, etc. All the information an attacker might need for identity theft. All right? Let's pretend OPA is susceptible to reflective cross-site scripting injection. It is not. I happen to write that one. It's been tested thoroughly for several years now. It doesn't have one, but we'll pretend for today. Now, Sean is going to send Jane a spoofed email. Sends her an email and says, hey, I found this job. You know, I know your husband. I found this job. I know you've been looking for one at the university. It's perfect for you. Sends it to her. She clicks on it. If she visits the URL while she's logged in and OPA happens to have a cross-site request forgery vulnerability, then I can, through cross-site scripting, grab that cookie ID, send it off-site to another server altogether. The attacker can then take that cookie ID, put it back into his browser, and take over Jane's account, getting to all of her information. That's the first type. Second type, persistent. Let's also pretend that OPA has a web form where the different applicants can go in and discuss resume techniques, jobs, etc. And we'll pretend that that forum has a persistent cross-site scripting injection vulnerability. Sean posts a thread to a forum containing the injection. Now, if you want to get a whole bunch of people to go to a web forum and read something, what do you usually do? Or let me ask it another way. Which threads in a forum are usually the most read? Put it that way. What's that? Stupid ones, inflammatory ones, right? Or somebody just says something just horrible, and everybody goes to look at it, all right? So we'll pretend that Sean does that. He goes in there and just says something awful. Jane happens to view the thread. The ejection runs, bypassing that same origin policy, sends her information back to Sean, and now everyone that views that thread is affected. No need for social engineering. All right, again, the last one, a little bit harder. Jane visits a compromised site. Malicious JavaScript on the page launches an attack against an HTML file that's local-based that happens to have a cross-site scripting injection vulnerability. It launches another attack now running as her admin account because she happens to run her XP machine as an admin. All right, so any questions on the three main types? Any so far? Okay, we'll jump into the live demo. I do have some bad news. Bad news is the sites that I normally use, there we go, I've been a little slow there to catch back up. Sites that I normally use for my demos have all fixed the vulnerabilities. So that's also good news. Bad news because I was a little kind of short for a good demo. So instead what we're going to do is we're going to pick on Stanford. Is anybody here from Stanford? Does anybody know David Hart from Stanford? I've been trying to get a hold of him for now for weeks to talk to him about this vulnerability. All right, if you happen to meet him here at the conference, please tell him to come visit me. All right, so let's go to Stanford. There it goes. Oh, my goodness, it's huge. All right. Now, on this page, unfortunately, I didn't mean for it to be this big, so let's see if I can get over here. Oops, wrong one. Let's do this. Okay. Kind of hard to see, I know, because the projector is projecting it so big. But where on this page so far that you see right away accepts user input? Search box, right away. So what I'm going to do as an attacker, I'm just going to basically walk you through the entire steps of how an attacker might do this. As an attacker, what I'm going to do is I'm going to see how the server responds to things that I give it. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a double quote, space, single quote, space, a less than symbol, a space, the string ABX space and an end character. Now, why might I use that collection of characters? Got a whole bunch of stuff. HTML, it's easy to find, okay? So let's think about this. What do you use to enclose an attribute in an HTML tag? Either double quotes or single quotes, right? All right, how do you start an HTML tag? Bracket there. How do you end an HTML tag? Bracket. ABX is just there for me to help find it. So I got a whole bunch of source code, just helps me find it a little bit easier. All right, so what we want to do now is we want to see how the server responds. All right, came back. Let's take a look at the source here. Is that font big enough for everybody to see? All right, let's see what we got. So we got ABX. So what did they do? They left the quote. They left the single quote. They escaped the less than symbol, encoded into HTML entities. They left the ABX, and then encoded this, the end. Now that's no good. I can't do anything with that. What else did they do? In this case, down here, they encoded the double quote, left the single quote, left the less than, left the ABX, then encoded the greater than. Still can't do anything with that. Let's see. That time, they URL encoded it. Can't do anything with that. Back to the same thing again. Another URL encoding. URL encoding. Stripped out some stuff. Stripped out some stuff. Stripped out. There's nothing in here. Okay, so no good this time. Oops, close this. But what else do we have in here, though? What else might be accepting some input when you're looking at this? Right? We searched for Stanford Web. Let's search for people. See what happens there. Here, let's try it again. There we go. It's in the source. Oh. All right. Looks like they. Whoops. Let's go back to that one. It's like they stripped it out, or they quoted, they encoded it there. Stripped it out. They stripped out everything. Can't do anything with that. What else accepts input here? Maybe the URL is kind of small. Oh, who said that? Ah, yeah. What? Look right here. Search within. What is this? Drop down list, right? That's user input. How many of you have used Firefox? Good. How many of you use the Web Developers Toolbar in Firefox? Oh, even better. All right, so you guys are familiar with the Web Developers Toolbar. All right, so in the form option, one of the things that we can do is convert select elements to text inputs. So I can change that drop down list, what they've got here as everyone, university, faculty, staff, etc. I can change that over to a text area. Ah, yeah, so I can change everyone. We'll do the same little string. I'll go back up here and change this ABX to Smith. And now let's see what happens. What happened? Just right off the bat, can you see something wrong? Yeah, something's not right with that. That's not what I should be seeing, right? So let's take a look. Let's look at the source on this. And let's find it here. ABX. See why I wanted to be able to find this thing faster? It's kind of hard. So what's happened? What was that? Ah, yeah. Not only that, we got a quote that's now ending the href, essentially. And then we got a closing bracket, which is, as far as the browser is concerned, is telling it that that anchor now is done. So do you remember buffer overflows from a couple years ago? This isn't a buffer overflow, but it's kind of the same thing. We're trying to, as an attacker, we're trying to break out of what we're supposed to be placed into so that we can get stuff into the page and take over that DOM. All right, so let's try something. Let's go back in here, do the same thing, change that to So what I did is I've got, let's go back this way a little bit. Got an in quote, because remember it left in that quote, I told it to end the attribute. I'm going to tell it to end the anchor, and then I'm going to insert my own script tag. We'll see what happens. So what does that mean? It means there's probably a problem there. All right, now you might be thinking, okay, well, let's look at the URL. I mean, we got a scriptifier, but no query string. So what method is the form using? Post. Now, you can still launch an attack if the form's using post. It's not easy, it's still possible, but it's definitely not as easy as using the get method, right? So what we want is an attacker to be able to use the get method. It just so happens that in the form, on the toolbar thing, we can convert form methods from post to get. And we'll put our little string back in here and see if it lets us do it. Script alert one. Still did it. And every time I deploy it, it displays it. I did this many times though. Oh, really? I should have picked a different person. Oh my gosh. Whoops. Oh man. All right. Ah, I thought I was done. Oh. I should have searched on a different name. Jeez. All right. Yeah, let's see. We'll go over to, I can't. Hold on. Yes, I can. We'll go over to Safari. Let's kill that one for a second. Go to Safari real quick. All right, but you might be saying, all right, that's fine, you know, but what's an alert do? Alert's no big deal, right? Alert's no big deal. No big deal. Let's say instead that I change it to not just say alert, but to do a script source. Now what's it going to do? It's going to load in what? Whatever that URL points to. That URL happens to point to one of my sites that contains a JavaScript file. I happen to have the whole URL copied here. Already set up, and notice I didn't just put, you know, HTTP sourcing, I've kind of encoded it. So if a user saw it, they wouldn't quite know what it is. Even trickier, this happens to point to this. So instead, I can just copy this one. The page still loading. Uh-oh. Okay, now where are we at? We're still at Stanford, aren't we? Does it look like Stanford anymore? No. We've completely taken over the DOM. We've gotten rid of the background, we got rid of the entire contents of the body, and we embedded a YouTube video. All right, so if I can do that, what can I do? I can do anything I want, can't I? All right, this is the danger of cross-site scripting. Simply from injecting into a URL a payload, I can take over somebody's entire site. From there, I can launch cross-site request forgeries, and if you're not familiar with that, basically you take the cookie value. You know, when you log into a site, the site assigns you a cookie, and that's how it knows as you go from page to page to page who you are. Cross-site request forgery vulnerability is where the application doesn't do enough checks on that cookie value to make sure that the person who's saying they have this value is really that person. So I can steal that cookie value, put it into my browser, and assume that person's role or their account. This is the danger. Now, real quick, we're going to look at a persistent vulnerability. We'll go over here into Windows real quick because that's where my editor runs in. Maybe if the computer cooperates here. There it goes. Fire up my editor. How many of you do PHP development? This is just a side. You should check out Newsphere's PHP ED. It is an awesome, awesome application for development. It's very similar to Microsoft's .NET editor, a Visual Studio editor. It does code completions, etc. All right, so, sorry you can't really see this. Let's get rid of some stuff. Close this one out. Basically, this is going to... Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So we're going to run this. Looks like this is just a real rough, kind of like a Twitter type thing. It's just going to take user comments, store them, and then play them back to the users as they come visit. So let it fire up here. Should have given my computer some coffee. It's slow. Come on, load it. Usually it's not this slow. It's still loading. Maybe it's still trying to run those ones over in the other Firefox. That's probably what it is. Still got the alerts going. I can feel it churning. Jeez, come on. Why don't you do a little song and dance while we're waiting? Oh, there it goes finally. Okay, good. So again, just a real basic, going to accept some user input, then print those comments back out. So again, just like last time, I'm going to insert some comments here. All right, leave a comment. Let's look at the view source here. See what it did. Do anything to it? Absolutely not. Didn't do a thing to it. Just spit it back out verbatim. Probably the worst thing you could possibly do. So now let's put another comment. Oh. No, I did not want to go to the weather. Let's try one more time. Go back there. There we go. All right. Instead, what I'm going to try to do, I'm going to do a little script. So what did it do this time? Put that script, put it right back into the page and ran. The problem here is now it is stored permanently. That means any user that comes here, hopefully IE won't take as long to load, but any user that comes to this site now is going to have that attack replayed back to them. So now if I go into IE and I go to that same website, bonk, and it's going to play every single time. This is how the Twitter worm spread. It got stored into users' profiles, and then when you went to look at their profile, it went into your profile and just kept spreading. And was stored. This was a persistent cross-site scripting vulnerability. All right, so any questions so far? Anything? Yep. It's the exact same problem. You can't trust anything. In fact, we're back up here. Oops, there we go. What can we do to protect our sites? Yeah, exactly. Paranoid. There it is. Put on your tinfoil hat. The best thing you can do is be paranoid. Be very paranoid. Now, I am paranoid by nature. For example, I brought 3 white shirts of the exact same, so if I spilled coffee on one before my presentation, I had 2 backups. That's how paranoid I am. So you cannot trust anybody as a developer. You can't trust any input at all. You have to assume that every piece of data, no matter where it's coming from, it doesn't matter if it's coming from the database or the external, it is a potential attack. You have to check everything. Again, and write down again, but another thing is layers or a defense in depth. It's a military strategy. What you do is instead of just having one defense, you have a whole bunch of defenses. So an attacker has to continuously fight to try to get from one or through one to the next one to the next one. Because most attackers are pretty lazy. What they're looking for is the low-hanging fruit. They're looking for the sites that have vulnerabilities, that are wide open, that they don't really have to do a whole lot of work for. Now, that's not to say they won't still attack you, because as educational institutes, as you pointed out, we have additional problems, and we have student information, and that information is valuable. Brand new credit histories that they can take advantage of. So anybody can finally get through, but what you want to do is make it as hard as possible to get through. So some things that we can do to protect our apps. Input filtering. Input filtering is also referred to as blacklisting. So one of the sites earlier we saw was stripping stuff out. You know, put that double quote in, it took it away. That's blacklisting. But what's a problem with blacklisting? You've got to think of everything. You got to think of every possible thing that somebody could use. As an example, we'll go back to American Red Cross today. Just found this one as we were sitting in there. Is that American Red Cross? Yeah, it's American Red Cross. And Safari's being funny. That's annoying. Okay. They have a little search box. So we're sitting in there in the presentation. I went to American Red Cross. I went to check it out. Did the exact same thing. I said, all right, here we go, ADX. Cool. It's loading. Ah, what happened there? It spit it out. Well, it might not spit out everything, but at least I know that double quote. They didn't include that double quote, so I was able to pop out, wasn't I? All right, now let's try a little bit more sophisticated. Let's try like a script alert and see what they do. Yeah, no doubt. They're looking. Come on. Try again. Yeah, we'll skip this demo. Let's go right back in. All right, so it's too hard to try to catch everything. In the American Red Cross, I found a vulnerability. Basically, they stripped out script tags. They stripped out parentheses. They stripped out quotes. But I was still able to find one through using some other JavaScript tricks. If we get time, I'll try to show you at the end. But you can't keep up with it. You just can't keep up with a blacklist. It's okay. It's not something you shouldn't do. You should do filtering. You should look for those things and take them out if you can. But you can't rely on it as your only defense. The second one is input validation. Back when we saw Stanford, we changed the drop-down list, the text, and we were able to inject there. What could we have done? What could they have done to block that attack? Server-side input validation. Only accept post will help. But on that validation, that was a list, wasn't it? So what should they accept? Only things on the list, right? Most likely that list came from an array. So all they have to do is go back and say, all right, for this input, if it's not in that array, spit it out. That's validation. Only accept things that you're expecting to accept. Output encoding, we saw that happen. Should output encode everything possible. If you encode a greater than symbol, well, I can't bust out of that. I have to have that in tag there to get in there. Another thing you can do is called a web firewall or an intrusion detection system. This is another layer that sits on top of your app. And what it does is it scans inputs as they come through and it scores them. Now, it doesn't block them, it just scores them. It looks at the post, it looks at the get contents, and it says, all right, for each of these in here, here is a score on a possible attack. Then it's up to the developer to decide what to do with that score. So you can say, all right, if it scores more than a 15, we'll dump it out. That's probably an attack. Yeah, it's just another layer. You can also tidy the output. I don't know, has anybody messed with HTML tidy before? Have I looked at a couple of you? What it does is it takes HTML and then tries to conform it to some standard. So if you give it an open paragraph tag and an end div tag, well, it's going to try to convert that div into a paragraph so it matches up there. All right, so if you're doing that, if you're tidying the output, well, then I can't try to break out in the quotes and everything because it's going to try to clean all that up and not leave anything unstandard. You can also use anti-SAMI, which happens to be part of the OWASP, which is the Online Web Application Security Project. Remember all that. It is a library to do exactly encoding. It was developed shortly after the SAMI worm to help get around some of these cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. All right, sorry about the demos being slow. Do you have any questions? Yes. Not specifically the same, but almost every language now has some type of security or anti cross-site scripting vulnerability library that you can use. If you go to the OWASP site, owasp.org, specifically they have an anti-cross-site scripting library for .NET, Java, PHP, pretty much all the major languages that you can take advantage of. Which will help. In general, it's another layer. You can't rely on it 100%. .NET does the same thing. They've got one. Unfortunately, there were .NET specifically. I don't know about this one, but at .NET, it would block all your image or not image text, all your tags, anything you try to put in that way, just give you an error page, except for end HTML. So what you could do is you could put an end HTML and then an on load and then fire it off again. So it helps. I'm not saying there is a vulnerability for that one, I don't know off the top of my head. It certainly helps, and it's definitely something you should use as a defense in depth strategy. I wouldn't rely on it 100%, because you don't know if it's going to take care of everything. Another question. I kind of mentioned that if you were paying attention to the jQuery session, the Twitter feed during the jQuery session, we talked about the validation plugin. Same thing. It's a framework. It's a great framework. Don't get me wrong. But you can't rely on client-side validation at all as far as for security. You can as a nice user feature, but not 100%. Same thing for server-side frameworks. You can't rely on them 100% because you didn't write it. You don't know what is and isn't in there. They might have gotten it all, but might not. Plus, a lot of those frameworks are open source, which means the attacker or an attacker can go in and read through those as well and look for vulnerabilities, possible vulnerability vectors. So again, defense in depth. That if you take anything away from here, defense in depth. You're going to use a whole bunch of different strategies built on top of each other. One other thing I would like to mention, and I had this question the last time I presented this, is what as a user can I do? In other words, I'm not a developer. I don't do anything. Maybe I'm a PR person. And it just as a user, what can you do? Unfortunately, not a lot right now. The newer browsers are doing a better job. IE8 has built in cross-site scripting vulnerability features to block against it. The newer versions of Firefox do it. The newer versions of Chrome do it. And they're good to a point, but they're still not 100%. So as a user, you can certainly upgrade to the latest versions, but you still got to be careful where you go. You can use NoScript. Even NoScript has some. I happen to know the guy that writes NoScript. And there's still a few that gets through. He is excellent. He's very good. He usually takes care of immediately. Problem with NoScript, though, sometimes is it can disable the functionality of a website. It's annoying sometimes, which is why most users don't use it. I mean, a lot of people that are security conscious do, but the general average user is just too annoying for them. Any other questions or comments? All right. Are we on time, or do we got a few more minutes? Or oh, 1 minute. Maybe I can finish this up. Oh, it timed out. Okay, the gateway timed out. That's not good. Did I maybe my connection? Okay. Aha. Okay. Let's go in here. So it didn't do anything. Let's do this. Let's do on. Mouse over. I'll just do the one that works on this one. Okay, so we'll say a setter equals alert. Do it. Yes. A equals one. And if I hover back over, did I miss something up? Oh yes, I did. Hold on. Yes, I do need a quote. Thank you. That's what I needed. That's good. This working in Firefox. Can I even get to the new window? I can't even get to the new window. All right, well, that one works. I'll try to get through the rest of this. If you want to see it, I'll show it to you. Basically, a setter says create a as an object, take its setter method, make it an alias of the alert, then set a, the object, to one, which passes the one back to its setter function, which is the alert, and you get an alert. I know it's kind of complicated, but again, no parentheses. All I had to do was have a quote and then use on mouse over. And as soon as you mouse over, bomb. You can have it do location. You can have it set an alias to any of the built-in JavaScript functions. So again, back to that blacklisting, that's why you can't rely on blacklisting. Or you can open an iframe. So, cool. Sorry, I messed up on using Smith there. So I'll be here for the next hour. 15 minutes? What's the force quit on the Apple? What is it? Command option escape. Firefox force quit. Goodbye. Force quit. Thank you.